Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcast live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And this show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? The Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Joshua Plunkett, a chef who worked at prominent kitchens, including Noma in Denmark, Momofuku, and Atera in New York City. And Josh spent intense 7 months in Japan last year, cooking and discovering Japanese culture. Despite their interest in Japanese cooking, not many non-Japanese chefs get to work in a kitchen in Japan, partly because of the restaurant's policy, language barriers, visa, etc. So today, Josh will discuss his unique experience in Japan as a chef and a curious traveler, and what he discovered there. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and now on Spotify's podcast. Please go to iTunes and Stitcher and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. And you can email us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatayama.com. Now, let's start our conversation with Joshua Plunkett. Hello, Josh. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
Well, I'm from Dublin, Ireland, and I lived there till I was about 21, and then I came to New York. But eating when I was growing up, I guess my mum was a good cook, so we ate well. We were lucky to travel a lot as well around Europe, that kind of thing. So, but she used to cook a lot at home, like Irish food, like stews and lamb chops and that kind of thing.
I used to live in London, so cool. I really enjoy that. So how did you get into cooking professionally?
My interest in food definitely stemmed from my mother. And then we used to go and eat out a lot, I guess, when I was a kid. And growing up, and then when I was in Ireland, when you're about 16, you go in a thing called transition year in school, and you do work experience during the year. And I went to like a lawyer's office, and I went to an architect's, and I also went down to a place in the south of Ireland called Ballymaloe, which is a cookery school. I spent a week there, and there's a chef there called Doreena Allen. She's kind of like the Alice Waters of Ireland, kind of thing. So that kind of probably gave me like the bug, and then after that I went back and did the course after school, and she helped me go to a restaurant in Dublin. And then I did go to university and do philosophy, but I was always like cooking during it, and then during the summers. And then I guess when I finished university, I kind of fully went into it and decided I wanted to do it.
Right, and sounds like you really took a creative path as a chef. So you started at Noma in Denmark, and eventually you moved to New York in 2014. And so your resume is pretty impressive. So you worked at the Momofuku by David Chang and Luxus and Toast by Daniel Burns and Atera, which has two Michelin stars. So what did you learn from these restaurants?
I started in Dublin in Chapter One, which is a one-star restaurant. The chef's Ross Lewis. And that was fun because, I guess I was like didn't really know much at all then, and you know, that was just, everything was new. And I remember the chef, the head chef at the time was Garrett Byrne, and he was like, you need to be like a sponge, you just have to take everything in. So I did that, and then I was in university, and then I went to stage at Noma for a summer, and then I started coming over to the States as well, yeah, and then Momofuku, and then yeah, I went to Luxus and Atera. I guess aside from the food at each restaurant, you know, which was different, I mean, Momofuku sort of like Korean American kind of stuff, and then Luxus and Atera was Nordic. I guess you learn things from each chef, you know, specifically, and then the people you work with, and to some extent that kind of shapes you. And each restaurant has its own set of challenges, and I guess like whether it's just like difficult food or the actual physical layout of the restaurant, I guess like you run around and navigate your way through those, and that's kind of how you learn, I guess.
Right. I mean, all the restaurants, Momofuku and Luxus and Taurus and Atera, they were really totally different independently,
yeah.
Right?
So yeah, that's true. Yeah. Also, I mean, I guess, yeah. I mean, Atera was like a tasting menu. Luxus was tasting menu, but also Taurus, so we did the bar food as well. So that was like kind of a mix of the two. And
That's a beer restaurant. And then in the back.
Yeah. That was quite unique, really.
Right.
And then Momofuku was Korean, but it was, I guess it was a lot more covers, like high, kind of high covers, which was different to Luxus and Atera.
Right. So I'm curious though that you are from Ireland, but you decided to come to the States and then eventually you go to Japan. So is that something in your mind you want to discover new things?
I guess, yeah, I've definitely always liked to travel and I like going home, but I also like, I like being away, I guess. And it's just, everything's so new and different all the time. So I guess you get to learn that way, and yeah, I guess it's exciting.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about your experience in Japan now. So you went to Japan from January to August 2017, and you cooked only Western food up until you went to Japan.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So how did you find an opportunity to cook in Japan?
I had a friend who went to university in Dublin, and he was working for a Japanese chef in London. And he had actually left London. He'd moved out to Kyoto to work in a kaiseki place.
So with a Japanese guy?
Yeah, with a Japanese guy,
okay,
yeah.
Right.
Who, yeah, it was called Nakazen. And Nakazen actually worked at Kikunoi for about 10 years.
Kikunoi actually is one of the best, three Michelin star kaiseki restaurants in Kyoto.
And old. So I guess I was talking to Giles, and then through the chef that he worked for in London, I kind of arranged to go out to Japan, and they helped organize, I guess, the trip and, you know, set me up with some contacts and people to meet and work for. So that's kind of how it came about. I mean, it would have been very difficult otherwise. It is tricky to go over there. You know, everything's so different, and the language is obviously a big barrier when you're trying to organize things like that.
Yeah. Right. So, but you were interested in going to totally new environment, because you said you never been to Asia before.
Yeah, I'd never been to Asia before, so I mean that was like going to be a crazy massive adventure. So I guess, yeah, it was kind of mad. I mean, I guess I just like dropped everything here and just left New York, and I went to Japan, and I didn't really know what was going to happen, to be honest, but it worked out all right.
Fantastic. That's most exciting. So where did you work in Japan?
Well, I worked in Kyoto, which was really cool. I'm glad I went to Kyoto in the end. It was a restaurant called Taiho, and it's a family restaurant just near Nijo Station. And they serve Chinese food, Sichuan food. The chef he's called Koki, and he's cool. He's about 36 or 37, but his dad actually opened the restaurant in the early 70s, and he was about 24 when he opened the restaurant. He's 70 now, and he works every single day, 6 days a week, and has done since he was 24. It's absolutely insane. Yeah, it was super crazy work ethic. So yeah, and then I work 6 days a week, from about 8:30 in the morning to like 1 a.m. kind of thing. But it was cool. We used to go in and we would sit down, we'd have breakfast together. And then we would do lunch, and then we would sit down and eat our family meal, like Mac and I, we used to call it. And then we would do dinner service, and then we would all sit down again after and eat together.
Wow.
And the restaurant was kind of unique in the sense that like it was Sichuan food, and they served loads of natural wine as well.
Wow.
So that was really cool, really interesting.
That's because of the second generation.
Absolutely. Yeah, Koki kind of like took over when he was 26. So he's been in charge about 10 years now. But Taisho still works every day. And I mean, I guess the funniest thing about it was that, like, it was a family restaurant. So, like, the sister worked, the mother, Oka-san, she cooked all the noodles and all the dumplings, and Taisho did all the old dishes, like the, you know, yakisoba and the all the kind of older, like, traditional Chinese stuff. And then Koki does all his new stuff. So it was good. I'd never worked in, like, a restaurant with just... It was so family-oriented, and they lived above the restaurant stuff, because you just don't really get that in New York, you know?
Oh, wow. I don't think even in Japan either.
Yeah, maybe not.
Yeah, it sounds like you became a part of the family.
Yeah, almost, yeah.
Right. But is that because of your friend who introduced you to that Chinese restaurant?
Yeah, I mean, he was friends with Koki, and I think, I guess, from their perspective, and they're probably right, like, my training in New York had been quite fine dining. And like tasting menus and all that kind of stuff. So I guess it was trying to move me away from maybe that a little bit, because Taiho's just like a little tiny neighborhood restaurant. They do like loads of people for lunch and loads of people for dinner. So it was like a departure from kind of rigid, fancy tasting menus.
Right. Yeah. So, but you know, the Koki, the second generation, mm-hmm. he wanted to transform the restaurant into something totally new.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happened was he took over, and Koki trained around Kyoto in Chinese restaurants as well. And he spent a little bit of time in China. Like, he speaks enough Chinese to, like, communicate with them. But there's no Chinese people actually at Taiho. But he just kind of, like, if Koki's interest, he's incredibly, he was just, like, super curious. So he just decided he liked natural wine. And then so there's a girl, Misa-san, and she's like the sommelier. So she came, and she does all the wine program, and then I probably, because they brought in natural wine, it's changed the nature of the restaurant, because it brings in, there's a very good wine shop in Kyoto called Ethelwein. And so there's a whole crowd of natural wine people, especially from Europe, who, you know, come to Japan, and they go to Egami-san, he brings them to Taiho. So for Koki, that opened up a whole new world of things. Yeah. So, like, now he goes to Europe. I went with him in September. We went to Paris and Barcelona, and we did dinners in Vervale and Barbarital, which are natural wine bars, and doing Chinese food.
Right. So, kind of Japanese Chinese food, actually.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it's Chinese, but with a very sort of Japanese sensibility, and all the ingredients are Japanese. I mean, they buy some stuff from China, but, like, they use omi beef and, you know, amazing tofu from Kyoto and all the amazing fish and vegetables from Kyoto.
Right. So, yeah. So omi beef is a wagyu beef, very fatty and expensive, but the local regional specialty. And so Kyoto vegetables, I heard it's like around 40 different nationally designated Kyoto vegetables.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. I mean, I just remember so there was a guy who would forage them. Because in springtime, Kyoto's famous for its water.
Right.
And also, so, I mean, that's why all the kaiseki's there and everything, and all the dashi is amazing, all that kind of stuff. But they
grow softer. Water, right?
So they get incredible vegetables, just like really unique little things I'd never seen before, like fukinodo and all those kind of things.
Right.
So it was really cool to see all that coming in.
But, you know, for listeners who are not familiar with Japanese Chinese food, I mean, there's so many Chinese restaurants in the whole country.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, surprisingly, I've never heard of any non-Japanese person working for a Chinese restaurant in Japan, especially in Kyoto.
Yeah, it was kind of funny. I mean, it's funny because the mother and Koki, they kind of look Chinese, but I mean, they're actually not.
Okay, so did you speak Japanese that time?
No, I mean, I went over and I spoke absolutely no Japanese, nothing. I didn't even know how to say thank you properly. And then, I mean, every day, I guess it was just, you know, they would bring me something and it was like, you know, a fish and it was a mackerel, and they'd be like, point at it, and they'd be like, saba. So I'd try to remember. And then the next day it was something else, and... you know, a carrot, ninjin, and then just, I literally built it up like that, just like every day, like trying to learn like a new ingredient. And then, you know, I mean, my Japanese is extremely limited, but I remember after about, it was really hard at the start because I just couldn't understand anything. And like everything was new. But the mother, Oka-san, she would call out the orders. And I remember, like, I just couldn't make a word of it. I didn't know what she was saying. And then after about 4 or 5 weeks, she would call out things, like it would be like, yodale dore, and I would be like, I'd know what it was. And I was that was like a turning point when I started to like understand what was going on. And kind of your level of interaction then was able to like increase.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm, okay. And so you naturally, you know, share the whole day, right? Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Mm-hmm. So did you communicate by hand?
I mean, well, Misa-san, the wine girl, she spoke English. Mm. Yeah. But everybody else in the kitchen didn't really have any English at all. So it was tricky. I mean, Daisuke, he was the sous chef, we used to use a lot. There was a lot of Google Translate.
Mm.
But then we kind of just came up with, like, you know, words that I understood or they understood. And we had our own little language kind of thing that, like, made it work. Mm. But gradually, I got a grasp of it. And then in a restaurant, you're only working within a certain kind of boundary, as it were. Like, you know, I probably had 40 jobs that I did.
Mm.
So, you know, once I learnt them, you know, I learnt the name for cabbage or the name for whatever, and I knew what the preparation was, and they just could say it and I could go and do it then.
Mm, so yeah. The chef's language helped.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. Kitchen language.
Mm, it must be encouraging for listeners who might be interested in going to Japan and cook
yeah,
without
for sure.
Language.
I mean, it's possible. You just need to go and do it. It's hard, mm. but it's worth it.
Right. And what about the visa? Did they take?
The visa thing for me, luckily, was really, really straightforward. I mean, because I'm used to going to the American embassy, which, you know, it is what it is. And I went to the Japanese embassy. I flew home from America at Christmas, and I went from the airport straight to the Japanese embassy because I was under a little bit of time pressure to get my visa ready over Christmas for January to go.
Right.
So I went in, and I was there for 11 minutes.
Hmm.
And I got a working holiday visa, which is a one-year visa for Japan, and it lets you pretty much work in any field you want.
Hmm.
But I don't think it's available for Americans, which is unfortunate.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. There is a list on the like Japanese kind of embassy site of the countries that can do it. Mm. But I'm pretty sure America isn't one of them, unfortunately.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I understand that Japan, at least it used to be like with Australia, and you can go work for a year or something like that, right? Okay. And so you are in charge of cooking Chinese at Taiho? And
yeah, well, I mean, I wasn't really in charge of anything per se because I guess I couldn't. It was tricky, especially in service when it was like super fast paced to communicate.
Mm.
But I used to work. I worked with the little young guy, and he was called Kaji.
Mm.
So like starting off, I would kind of just do prep, and then I would like. Then I started like plating dishes and starters, and obviously like over time. I mean, after like a month or two, I was like settled and relatively capable, so I was able to do other things. And then Koki would always, he started letting me do like pretty much do all the fish butchery, which is amazing. So like he taught me a lot of that, and I learned how to like, we used to serve soup on like turtle.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned how to like butcher turtles, and we did frog. And Koki was like, he would just go to the fish market and buy all this like mad stuff I'd never seen before, and then like he would do one or whatever, and then he'd let me do the rest and stuff. So that was really cool. I learned a lot about fish, and he taught me how to do, you know, ikijime and all that kind of stuff.
Mm. Can you explain ikijime to the audience?
Yeah, I mean, I learned ikijime from Koki, and he doesn't really have a lot of English, so I just kind of learned how to do it. But I mean, basically, you just wallop the fish on the head, and then you cut it at its neck and at its tail, and then you open up the nervous cord, and then you have a special wire, and you just like put the wire down the core of the fish, down the nervous cord, and it just ruptures it all. So basically the animal like thinks it's kind of still alive, sort of, as it were, and it kind of decays in a different way, and you can like age the fish, it changes the texture, kind of thing.
Right. I heard that the fish even doesn't realize
it's
versus
dead.
Yeah, you're struggling and losing all the amino acids.
Yeah.
It's still alive.
Yeah.
In the fish mind.
Yeah.
Still dead. But and you just like draw out the blood, which keeps it really fresh.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, and now living in Kyoto, I'm super curious about that because a lot of Japanese people say Kyoto people are different.
Yeah.
And culturally, like, you're surrounded by thousands, literally thousands of temples and shrines.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, Kyoto people, I guess Kyoto was a little more traditional than Tokyo or whatever. I mean, they kind of live in their history, I guess, in Kyoto. But it was an amazing place to live, I think, for me coming to Japan and it being a new place, because it's sort of, I mean, I don't want to take away from the rest of Japan by any means, but Kyoto is a special place just in the sense that like you are surrounded by so much history and so many special, amazing, beautiful things. Like all the temples are incredible, and just being around all the kaiseki. Like I lived in Higashiyama, and there was a restaurant around the corner called Hyotei, and Hyotei's been open for 400 years.
Right.
which is crazy. And then, I mean, Michelin came over and gave them 3 stars. But when you're 400 years old, 3 Michelin stars is kind of irrelevant. It's just, it's special anyway, you know.
Right.
But it started off as a tea shop, you know, or like a tea house. And now they do like dinner and lunch and everything. But yeah, so they were just, I mean, Kyoto was an amazing place to live just because I was so immersed in kind of old Japan.
Right.
I guess.
Well, it's, you know, you said people live in history. What do you mean by that?
I mean, I guess Kyoto is more traditional and the buildings are traditional and the temples are all still there. And I mean, probably to some extent, I guess Kyoto wasn't bombed during the war because there was nothing really of strategic value.
Right.
So it remained intact. Like, I mean, Sapporo and Tokyo and stuff were pretty badly damaged. But
I heard that actually American government avoided because it's too beautiful.
Beautiful.
To destroy.
Yeah, I read that too. Like there was, I think it was like a general or something that went on his honeymoon to Kyoto and he remembered it.
Ah.
And he was like, we can't do that because it's a war for, we're trying to save humanity. Mm. So we can't destroy it.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Right. That's one thing about, what I found interesting was when I was speaking to Kyoto kaiseki chefs, and their business is not just serving dinners because they have to serve, cater to birth of babies, to birthdays, to funerals, of course, not to mention weddings. So their life is connected to the families for long, long years. I think Hyote is like 16th generation or something like that.
It's absolutely insane.
Right. So it's a, I think the fact that they're surrounded by shrines and temples, your life is more closely connected to religions.
Mm.
And also restaurants are already pulled into that kind of connection.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So, yeah. So it's like, you know, when I spoke to visit the kaiseki restaurant, and the chef said, we're busy. You have like our good regular customers.
Mm.
Like anniversary party or something. It's like the whole kitchen was catering the bento boxes.
Right.
Yeah.
And I guess as well, I mean, in kaiseki as well, it's kind of special in a sense because, I mean, tea ceremony is obviously so connected to like Taoism and Buddhism and stuff. And then kaiseki basically evolved from tea ceremony itself.
Right.
So, I mean, it's like, and it's just everywhere in Kyoto.
Right.
And Uji's right there as well.
Mm.
With all the tea.
Right. Yeah. So you're really into tea, right? Japanese tea?
Yeah. I mean, I pretty much probably just from Atera was kind of the first point because there was this amazing guy there called Jeff and he had an awesome tea program.
Right. And he was called the Tea Sommelier. I heard about him actually.
Yeah. And he would do, I mean, just like a wine pairing, we had a tea pairing. And I'm not really sure why. I guess I just took a liking to it, but I was just fascinated by it. And then he kind of set me up with a little like mini tea program for me.
Huh.
And I would buy stuff and try to learn about it and brew it at home. So then, yeah, when I went to Japan, I tried to make the most of it. And I mean, I visited tea farms. I actually, one of the funniest days I had was I went to Tokoname outside Nagoya to buy a teapot. It was my first proper day off from Taiho. And I don't know why. I mean, I guess it was tricky because you can't really Google these things because it's all in Japanese and I can't read Japanese. So I decided I'm going to go to Tokoname to buy this teapot.
Mm.
So I went, I got the Shinkansen all the way to Nagoya on my day off. I got another JR train all the way out to Tokoname to buy the teapot. And I got to the place, the middle of nowhere, and it was closed.
Oh, wow.
I traveled the whole way on the Shinkansen and everything. So yeah, so tea was a big part of Japan for me. I used to buy a lot of tea, and I bought a lot of tea ware, like all the nice little teapots and stuff. And I visited tea farms in Nara, and yeah, it was amazing. It was
cool. So visiting tea farms, like you make an appointment or just a?
Well, it's a bit tricky. I mean, that was one of the things that was great about living there was that you make all these contacts. I had a friend called Masayo, and she was actually a chef in New York for about 8 years.
Yeah, I know Masayo.
Do you know Masayo?
Mika Nagoshi, right?
Yeah, yeah. She was a good friend. So she, I mean, she's incredible contacts there, and she works with Nara Tourism Board. So she brought me. Yeah, we went and visited it, and yeah, she was friends with them, and they like made us tea and everything.
Well, Masayo, she's like a traveling chef because she had a restaurant in Kyoto.
Yeah,
and it closed.
Yeah,
and sold it.
Yeah.
To someone else.
She does a lot of dinners and stuff. She seems to have loads of fun. Really, she does pop up dinners and stuff. I know she's working on like a space kind of thing where she'll be able to do like special events with artists and, you know, right. craft people and that kind of thing, and do dinners with them and that kind of thing in Kyoto. Mm. So that's probably in the pipeline.
Right. It's very inspiring.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So how did you find the people in Kyoto in your eyes?
Oh, I mean, they were amazing. Yeah. I mean, I guess the one thing when I started to realize the difference was I used to go to Osaka on my days off, and there was a sous chef in Taiho from Osaka.
Mm.
He always used to talk about Osaka people.
Right.
And I realized that he was very kind of energetic and cheeky and jokey and all this kind of thing.
Mm.
And that was Osaka people. They're kind of like jokers right. and full of energy. And
yeah,
and
I heard of when you in Osaka, since you're really young, you have to try to be always funny. I have to come up with jokes.
Okay. I know they have. I'm not sure what it actually is in Japanese, but they have a greeting that they only use in Osaka. And it literally translates to, "Are you making money?"
Oh,
I'm not sure what it is, but like that's their greeting.
Right.
But yeah, so in comparison to Kyoto people, I mean, Kyoto people were a lot more reserved, quiet, and maybe I don't know if traditional is the right word, but you know, they were more focused on their history, I guess. Osaka is quite modern and like brash and loud. And like when I was in Osaka, people would come up to me and say hello and ask me what you know, where is I from, and da da. Well, in Kyoto, people are much more reserved and quiet.
Right. Yeah, that's classic. Is it there with adjacent cities, right? You can go in between and have
that. It was amazing, yeah, because I used to get the Keihan line, but it was a cool place to live because you had Kyoto, which was like amazing and beautiful and so much history. And then you could go to Osaka for dinner and just have like a crazy time.
Mm.
And then come back. It was kind of, it's unique to have like two massive, well, not massive cities, but big, big cities with such different personalities, like right beside each other. So it was cool.
Yeah, I think the Kyoto is based on like in emperors and the nobles.
Mm.
And when you are, this is really a classic Kyoto personality story. So if when you're asked, come over and come to, you know, our house, and you have to say no twice. If you say, like, okay, I'm coming, it's like, no, I didn't mean that. But then the third time you accept it.
Okay.
And whereas in Osaka, that's the city of commerce. Mm. So you negotiate. If you go to the market, like, you know, the greeting, how much money you're making, it's the same mindset. And their dialect is stronger. And they saw something is really straightforward.
Yeah.
But then it's kind of coded in the soft, like tones, and then you're stupid, they say. But if you say it's stupid in Japanese Tokyo language, it's kind of really harsh.
It's funny you should say that. So, because I used a lot of my Japanese I learned from the sous chef.
Mm.
So, and then when you're not studying it, you've no point of reference. It's all you know. So, I mean, I used to he used to teach me words, but they were like Osaka Ben.
Mm.
So like instead of wakalanai, I would be wakalahan.
Yeah.
And Japanese people, I think in Kyoto or when I went to Tokyo, and this like white guy was saying wakalahan, they just burst out laughing. They thought it was so funny. I guess it's like a, you know, just a bizarre accent to have.
Yeah, it's just funny. And then there's a culture of comedy in Osaka region. Right. So yeah, I think we had a great time there. All right, so let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about just regional cuisine discoveries even more. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Joshua Plunkett, a chef who worked at the prominent kitchens like Noma in Denmark, Momofuku, and Atera in New York City. And he spent intense 7 months in Japan last year cooking and discovering Japanese culture. So you've been talking about all different experiences for you in Japan, but I just wanted to ask you, you know, you worked at the Taiho in Kyoto, which is a Chinese restaurant. And how do you find the difference between Chinese and Japanese Chinese?
Yeah, I didn't really know. And then because I'd eaten Chinese food here, but I had nothing to go against because I'd never been to China. So I was at Taiho probably February, March, April, May. So I had about 4 months at Taiho, and then every year Koki takes everybody from their restaurant to China on a trip to learn. So last year they went to Hangzhou, and we went to visit a shokoshu brewery, like a Chinese sake.
Spirits distilled.
And so they sell this shokoshu at the restaurant, so they're friends with the guy, and he brought us all around Hangzhou. We went to Shaoxing, which is famous for the wine, obviously, and the vinegar. And we went to Longjing. The meals we had were pretty different to Taiho. I just remember these huge tables of just full of all sorts of different dishes. And the Chinese food had a lot of bones in it, I remember. So they kind of like would eat around them and spit the bones out and that kind of thing. We did go to one amazing place called Longjing Manor, which I think translates as Dragon Well Manor. And it's kind of like Blue Hill Stone Barns, kind of along those lines. It's a lot older, but the chef there is quite famous because he is basically trying to rediscover kind of old Chinese farming methods and old vegetables and trying to preserve it all because, now China's increasingly industrial. So people are getting removed from, you know, farmlands and these kind of areas where they've lived for a long time and getting moved into like big new cities, and all their jobs are changing. So this place is trying to like preserve all that kind of tradition and culture. So we went there and we had the most, it was a really amazing meal. Just with incredible ingredients. That was probably one of the best meals we had in China. There's actually there's an amazing documentary. Maybe we can put it on a link on the website or something. But it's all about Longjing, which was really cool.
Right. Well, you mentioned it's interesting that, you know, the style of Chinese cuisine. I think Japanese cuisine is more kind of subdued. And like kaiseki, people say the length of food has to be right for Dinah's mouse size.
Right.
Versus, you know, it's a more dynamic continental mindset of Chinese cuisine.
I mean, definitely in China, I had like three, it was like there's Chinese food in China, which is what I experienced. There was Chinese food in Japan that I experienced, and there was just Japanese food in Japan. I remember that the food in China was like incredibly abundant. I just remember they just brought us huge platters of things, and like there was more food than you could possibly eat. At Taiho, the Chinese food, this is back in Kyoto, was probably a little more refined. Like this is the Japanese restaurant. This is the Chinese Japanese restaurant that I was working in Kyoto, compared to China, was much more like refined. It was a little more kind of delicate, and there was a little more finesse to it than the Chinese food in China.
Right. I mean, if you go to Yokohama, that's the Chinatown in Japan, it's just a totally more Chinese. Although I think still, you know, there's a variation of Japanese applications, but that's interesting that you observe the difference. Right. And so I heard that you, while you're in Japan, you visited many cities in Japan outside Kyoto, including, of course, Tokyo and Shizuoka, Mie, Osaka, Hiroshima, Sapporo, Hakodate, Okinawa, Fukuoka, Kanazawa. That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Right. So one thing I I heard that you stayed with a farmer in Mie Prefecture.
Yeah, the first month in Japan, I was staying with a Japanese chef in Tokyo, and he took us on a little trip around. We basically drove from Tokyo to Kyoto.
Wow.
But we stopped off along the way. It took about a week, maybe just over a week. But yeah, we spent a lot of time in Mie, and we stayed with this farmer who just lived in this tiny valley. It was crazy. There was no phone coverage or anything. It was really amazing. And she used to grow, she grows vegetables. She's about 79, I think. Her name is Kosan. So it was amazing. We lived with her. I just remember it was absolutely freezing. So cold. But it was amazing. And she would cook us dinner every night, and we all sat around together and ate this, like, just food that I'd never seen before. It was totally different. And then we would help her during the day. Like, we went picking gobo, and we picked yuzu off the trees, and we made yubeshi.
The Japanese sweets.
Yeah. Right. So that was amazing. And she, basically her business was to grow vegetables, and then she would grate them, and she would dry them outside. And then she would package them all and sell them as, like, yasai dashi, kind of like vegetable dashi, ready to go kind of thing. But she was famous for, like, her vegetables, because she was, like, completely kind of organic, all that kind of thing.
So she's been farming for years and years.
Oh, years and years and years.
Right.
But it was a little bit sad, just because she had a son, and the son was a plumber or electrician or something, and he lived at home, but he had decided that he wasn't going to take over the farm. And I think that maybe that's something that's happening in Japan a little bit. It's just like the younger people maybe aren't quite as kind of ingrained into the tradition. Maybe they're like certainly not, you know, they're going to move away from it a little bit.
Right. Yeah. And especially there's no phone enough heat.
So I guess it was an amazing experience, but also I did wonder, like, what was going to happen.
Well, Mie is actually pretty close to Kyoto and Osaka. I'm actually Nara, next to Nara Prefecture. So I'm sure the farmers are in demand for. Used to be serving, you know, all those restaurants.
Yeah.
Right. So hopefully, yeah, we have to support them. Okay. And also, I heard you discovered a donabe.
Yeah, we visited a donabe maker.
So what is donabe for the listeners?
I mean, donabe is like a big clay pot that you can cook in. And we went to one in Iga called Durakugama. And I have three of them now. I bought a beautiful rice cooker, and I bought a donabe. And then just my last trip to Japan in January, I bought a big, thick, heavy one. And yeah, you can basically make hot pot with them at the table.
Right.
Just like, it's like a crazy big meal that everyone kind of jumps in and involves in, and it's really good fun.
Right. Yeah, so I heard donabe, it's special because they're cracks that's made in each one.
Yeah, so like this guy in Durakugama, he makes everything by hand, and he uses just like it's a special clay from the area. So that the more you use it, it kind of ages, and it becomes unique to you. Like, your donabe will look unique, and they become more. The more you use them, and the longer you have them, they become more beautiful.
Because the cracks absorb whatever was inside, and then becomes its own kind of art.
Yeah,
right. And I think donabe is also, it's because it's clay and it cooks well. And it can hold a high heat and retains it.
Yeah. So it's, I guess, when we cook here with like pots and stuff, you just kind of turn the pot off and it stops boiling. But depending on the material of your donabe and how thick it is, you know, there's a residual heat in the donabe. It'll stay bubbling. So like, you can cook things gently. So I mean, things like tofu or like some Japanese ingredients are kind of delicate. So you don't want to have like a lot of harsh heat, you know? So you can just, once the donabe is hot, you can turn it off, but there's still heat in the pot and it'll cook it really gently.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think almost, I wouldn't say every whole household, but many households in Japan have donabe.
I'm sure, yeah.
Right. And it's fun, you know, put the gas,
it's amazing.
You know, heat on
it's
the
really
table.
It's really good fun. Yeah. And then the way you kind of get like a coursed meal, as it were, it's cool because it's just one thing on the table, but it keeps changing.
Because you keep adding
ingredients, you take things out, you put fish in, then the all the flavor from the fish goes into it, the fish comes out, and then your leftover rice, you put the rice in, and you keep cooking it, and you make a porridge, and then you can pour egg in on top of that, and yeah, it's just super fun.
Right,
and
so over time, yeah, throughout the dinner, you're cooking kind of dashi in itself.
Yeah.
Right, so that's, there's now this donabe, D-O-N-A-B-E, clay pot. Okay, so I'm curious, what did you see in Kanazawa?
Kanazawa, well, I wanted to go... and then I didn't really have a chance, but I had a friend who actually worked in the same restaurant I did before me called Tom, and he's married to a Japanese girl, and she's from Kanazawa, so he was able to give me a load of really good recommendations. So my parents actually came over to visit just right at the end of my time in Japan, and we went to Kanazawa, and I went to probably one of the best meals I've ever had, which was, it was a sushi meal in a place called Sushi Makumi in Nonoichi. It's really in the middle of nowhere, just like out in these kind of rice fields and a little like kind of collection of houses. But it just was absolutely stunning. It was amazing. And he basically makes sushi just from Ishikawa Prefecture. So he just uses all the fish from Ishikawa. And just, yeah, just the quality of it and just kind of the clarity of the meal was just incredible. It was amazing. I just remember we had like two things. We had a piece of grilled fish, which was just like absolutely mind-blowing. And then it was kind of fun as well because he made like a lollipop from ebi. It's like an ebi lolly, like a prawn lollipop. And he mixed it with rice and grilled it on the charcoal. It was really cool.
But,
yeah, and then we visited Kenrukuen as well, which is one of the three main gardens of Tokyo or of Japan. So that was like, just crazy beautiful.
Right.
Yeah. Kanazawa was kind of like a mini Kyoto.
Because traditionally it was known for architecture and gardens, and then because it wasn't damaged during the World War II, like Kyoto.
Yeah.
And it used to be, I heard, it's like fourth largest city in Japan. It's now like 30-something.
Yeah, it's way down there, yeah.
Because it's there's a big daimyo, like, you know, that noble person used to manage the land. So it was powerful. And also, I think it's known for the abundance of gold leaf craftsmen.
Okay.
So did you see gold leaves on any food?
I can't remember. Not in Kanazawa, no.
Yeah, like if you go Kaiseki restaurant, there's a gold leaf on top and then just a gold leaf ice cream.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the touristy places. Actually, outside of Kenrokuen, there's an ice cream shop.
Okay.
And there's gold leaf on top of ice cream.
I missed that.
Yeah. Anyway, so they also, finally, you went to Hokkaido. Right.
Yeah, I went to Hokkaido.
How was the experience?
Hokkaido was amazing. I mean, I went to Hokkaido twice, actually. I took one trip. The first trip, I went with one of the guys I worked with. He spoke a tiny bit of English, enough to communicate and say, do you want to go to Sapporo with me? So we decided to go for a weekend, and that was really good fun. I went to another sushi place, which was mind-blowing as well, and it was called Sushi Miyakawa. And it's actually one of the newest 3 stars in Japan because the Michelin guide gave him 3 stars. But he's very young, and we went to the restaurant, and he has, I mean, it just, the quality was mind-blowing. It was amazing meal, and it was cool because I guess he had a couple of girls working in the sushi kitchen as well, which in Japan is actually quite unusual. So that was really cool to see. And then just basically the overall experience in Miyakawa was amazing. I was just so impressed by their, like, the hospitality. And just, it was just an incredible restaurant. And just the fact that they were, it was new, it was a new restaurant, but it was just so good. It was amazing, yeah. That was Sapporo. We visited Nika Whiskey as well. And Aichi, is it Aichi? I think it was.
But you know, Hokkaido, you mentioned, you know, Hokkaido sushi place and a Kanazawa sushi place. And then I'm sure you found different types of, you know, different species of fish because Hokkaido, I think people used to call it gaichi, means outside the mainland.
Right.
Like, and then their culture is different. They have a huge land. I heard it's the best snow in the universe.
Yeah.
And also the Kanazawa, going back quickly, you know, it's a Kanazawa, it's the Noto Peninsula. So the coastlines are very complicated and it's facing the Japan Sea. So you see something like Nodoguro, that's a very particular fish. And so I think my point is, if you travel all around Japan, just eating at sushi place, you can see so many different kinds of fish.
I mean, I guess from Hokkaido, I mean, I went back recently and I went to Hakodate as well. We actually did go to Niseko for snowboarding, and the snow is ridiculously amazing. But Hokkaido, I guess the thing that struck me was probably the crab, which is just everywhere. And then uni as well. And you can go and have these massive, like, kaizen don,
yep.
just covered with king crab and urchin and stuff for $15, and it's just mental. It's crazy.
Right, it's so worth it. Just flying over.
Yeah, totally. Amazing.
Right. Okay. All right. So, so what are you traveling around in Japan? Did you find any specific dishes that you liked? And perhaps you can.
I mean, probably too many to mention, but I did pick a few. The first one is kind of a funny one. When I arrived in January last year, I got incredibly sick. I got the worst flu ever. Mm. It was so bad. And I was super, super weak. I could barely stand up. And it was also right on my birthday, on my 29th birthday.
Oh.
So I was in Akabane, just lying on the couch like a zombie.
Mm.
But I really needed to eat. And it was super cold outside.
Right.
But
like, Akabane is like a little, you know, it's in Tokyo. It's
like
an obscure city.
Yeah,
like.
Yeah. So this was Akabane, Kita.
Mm.
And so I managed to get the energy together. I could barely stand up. I was just so sick. I think it was just from traveling, and then I was in a new place, and just, I don't know, must have got a bug or something. But I was super, super sick. But I went down just to like the most basic Japanese curry shop, and I got it takeaway, and I brought it up. And I remember it was actually on my birthday, and I sat there eating the curry, and it was just so good. It's a good thing to have when you have a cold as well, because it's spicy.
Right. The Japanese curry is thicker and more kind of like a denser.
Yeah. It wasn't extraordinary, but just because of the conditions and the time, it was amazing. I always remember that. That was the first time. I always remember that curry.
Right. And
then I probably had there was so many amazing kind of home cooking meals.
Mm.
So like when we stayed with the farmer, we went to an incredible, amazing ryokan in Mie as well after the farm. And it was a family, and they had actually lived near Fukushima.
Okay.
I don't think they even farmed. And then after the tsunami and everything, they decided it wasn't a good place to raise their children. They were afraid of the land and the water and that kind of thing. So they moved to Mie and they started farming. And it was just a young couple, and they had a son, and they just gave us the most incredible meal. It was amazing. So that was really special.
Right. So it's a ryokan, meaning ryokan serves breakfast and dinner, right? Make you futon and all those things.
Yeah.
So that must be amazing.
And then I went to another, there was one really special place outside Kyoto called Miyamaso. Which was a ryokan as well.
Famous.
Yeah, super famous. And it was probably one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. It was incredible. It's up way up in the hills. I think you can get the bus there, but you're probably better off driving if you're going. And it's been around for, I mean, hundreds of years. It was a temple.
Right.
And now it's a ryokan, like one of these kind of, like a B&B, I guess. But this is like another level. But, you know, we had the most incredible meal there.
It's the Sōjiki Nakahigashi.
Yes.
Restaurant, right?
Yeah, well, it's his, they're the same family.
Right. I heard it's hard to get a table.
Yeah, it's hard to get a table. It's hard to get in. But they do this, it's they do a kaiseki-esque meal, but they call it a sumigusa, which means freshly picked. And because it's way up in the hills in Kyoto, and the hills in Kyoto are famous for, you know, all these incredible vegetables and all that kind of stuff. So they pretty much try to forage the whole meal for you from around the area. And we even had a carp sashimi, and they caught the carp. And carp is like obviously a freshwater fish, so it can be quite soily, like the flavor tastes like muddy. But they keep the fish alive for 2 weeks in spring water, and they filter it out. So the fish naturally filters itself for the clean water, and then they kill it. And then they serve it. That's why they're able to serve it for sashimi.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was amazing.
So, I heard there's a chef, Forage. He forages every morning for the restaurant.
In Miyamaso?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, that the Hassan? Is amazing in Miyamaso, because it's just it's a collection of all these tiny little amazing things from around. Like we'd river shrimp, and there was like fukinodo and cured egg yolk, and just everything from around the area.
Right.
Like it was just like the most incredible expression of like the area and the season.
So amazing. This Hassan is the name of the second course of kaiseki cuisine.
Yeah.
And it's a collection of like 3 to 5, it used to be I think 2 to 5 different kind of little things. So that's like the best part of the restaurant. Like,
cool.
Yeah, so that's great.
You can tell like what time of year it is.
Actually, you know, the son of Nakahigashi-san, the chef.
Is in New York. Yeah, he was working in New York.
Yeah, he was on Kijitsu, the show too.
I think, as well at some point.
He used to be, yeah. But he's doing interesting things. Yeah. So, yeah, hopefully I'm going to have him again on the show. Hi. And so after spending intense 7 months in Japan, what do you think is the essence of Japanese culture or Japanese food culture?
Yeah, I mean, that is super difficult. I mean, I guess even, for me personally, this whole Japanese thing is just like still learning. There's so much to learn. Like, I don't feel I'll ever understand it kind of thing. It's just like this massive journey it feels like now. But I guess, I mean, if I had to kind of pin down main sort of things that I picked up on, I guess the influence of other cultures in Japan is kind of prevalent, especially China. And then also, I guess, like after the Meiji period, when Western influence came back in, that even to this day is still kind of a big thing. So I guess in some ways Japanese culture is kind of like this battle of kind of their tradition and also this kind of like repeated absorption and refusal of other influences. Like, some of it comes in, some of it doesn't, and they're quite strong about like rejecting some of it, but then there's other aspects of other cultures that have become very ingrained into Japanese culture.
That's a very interesting point. Yeah, undeniably we have, you know, Chinese and Korean influence and also like Portugal, like back in like, you know, centuries ago, but we're discerning, like, you know, I'm sure you went to many pastry shops in Japan, which is completely like pure European styles.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. That how did they
And I guess as well, from when we lived with people, I mean, luckily I experienced this quite early on because it was when we went to the farm and stuff. But like Shinto religion, I guess, was a huge part. And I guess to go back to the point about kind of culture coming in and out, it was, I mean, Shinto has changed, like, and how it affects Japan kind of on a superficial level has changed a lot, but the core values of it have stuck through the culture and through the people even to this day. Even the young people, you can still see the kind of core values that kind of still exist.
I think one of the main features of Shintoism to me, the gratitude.
Like,
and this God everywhere, have to be more well behaved, respectful.
And then I guess just like to add to that, a couple of other things that I guess like totally blew me away was probably like when I first arrived in Tokyo, such a mass of people, but they have such respect for everybody else. And compared to probably living in New York, to be honest, I mean, their view of other people and how they're able to all live together, and they're so respectful of other people's space, and, you know, even just down to like the tiniest things, like they don't use their phone on the train, so it's nice and quiet and nobody has to listen to anybody else. It's just like a nice peaceful place, as opposed to here when the train's just like horrible. And then appreciation of craftsmanship in Japan is incredible. And you can see that through like knives, all the teaware. Like, I mean, I went to Raku, the exhibition. I mean, that was just phenomenal. And also, I guess they have an incredible concept of time and their understanding of age and respect for like the longevity of things, like Hyote existing for 400 years, or these, like, they have an incredible respect for time in that sense.
Right. Because, you know, the term wabi-sabi, like a tea ceremony. So wabi-sabi means it's rustic and it's a beauty in the rust. So that's a very particular mindset, I think.
I mean, I guess that, yeah, they appreciate the delicate nature of things. But we don't maybe to the same extent, I think.
Right. It's just nice to have the balance, I think.
Yeah.
Right. okay. So are you going to apply some Japanese elements to your future cooking? What's your plan?
I don't know really exactly right now. I'm kind of trying to figure that out. But I mean, I definitely feel, I mean, Japan will be part of my life for the rest of my life for sure. I mean, I really want to try and learn Japanese properly. I'd love to be able to read it at some point. So, I mean, yeah, I definitely plan on going back again and again and again. I'd love to think eventually I'd be able to go once a year. And I mean, I would totally if I could figure it out one day how to open a restaurant in Kyoto, like I would be more than happy to go live there. Right. It's amazing.
Wow, that's great to hear it. All right, so good luck. And where can we find your updates?
Nowhere really. I got rid of Instagram and Twitter before I went to Japan on purpose. So you just have to go to Japan yourself.
Okay, so the listeners, you have to just try to find Josh Plunkett.
Yeah.
Okay, so, well, really, keep me posted.
Cool, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, hopefully I hear about you in opening restaurants in Kyoto.
In Kyoto.
All right, so thank you. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or kikukatayama.com. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available anywhere in the world at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. And our engineer is David Tatsuyori, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.